This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 62 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, we're coming live from the Farnborough Airshow 2016. Tim Robinson and myself have been out and about, and we're going to bring you a sample of some of those people that we've had the opportunity to speak to today. It's been a fantastic day. The weather has been absolutely awful, as it has been all week, but that hasn't dampened down some of the enthusiasm and some of the excitement and around and about today. So without further ado, here are the interviews that we've recorded at today's show.
Okay, so here we are with Aviation Extended. It's the 2016 Farnborough Air Show, and we are on the awesome Boeing P-8 Poseidon with one of the RAF Seacorn crew, who is...
I am Flight Lieutenant Joe Ahrens.
Okay, and what is your role on the aircraft?
My role on the P-8 aircraft is one of a tactical coordinator, so I'm a tactical officer controlling the mission set, the task that we've been given to do, and also controlling the crew to achieve that task in the best way possible.
So you're kind of the overall kind of mission commander, supervising the
alongside my senior pilot colleague on the flight deck. Yes, we work as a team. It's not a one-man show. It's a multi-crew aircraft.
Now, you've been embedded at obviously the Seacorn has kept the UK's maritime patrol skills kind of going. So presumably you were on Nimrod before.
I was.
How does this aircraft differ from the Nimrod?
It's a step change in technology from where Nimrod Mark II was to where we are now with the P-8. The P-8 is a state-of-the-art, fully functional ISTAR platform. It can carry out the full depth of ISR taskings. The UK initially are going to use this aircraft in three major roles: maritime surveillance, anti-submarine warfare, and long-range search and rescue. So in a way of comparing them, it's apples and pears. You know, this thing is, as I said, state of the art. It's right at the forefront of this technology and of the mission sets we've been asked to carry out, and it's a leap forward in communication capability, certainly. But it does compare in some ways with the basic tasks that we perform, but the way we carry them out in the P-8 is obviously enhanced by the enhanced computers and especially communication systems on the aircraft.
Okay, and what are you guys kind of in being sort of embedded in a US squadron? What have you guys kind of brought to the party for the US? You know,
as part of the Seacorn project, as you mentioned earlier, we were tasked to maintain our skill sets in the ISR sphere. So being embedded with the US Navy has enabled us to use our experience to keep our skill sets at a decent level for when the UK procured the aircraft. But not only that, but also to help the US Navy transition from the P-3 aircraft to the P-8 aircraft, from a turboprop into a jet engine patrol aircraft.
And what's the working environment here? Because obviously this is, how does that compare to the Nimrod or the maritime patrol aircraft?
So if I could understand your question correctly, you're asking me to compare the working environment we have within VP-30. The working environment within VP-30 is essentially what we are used to in the old days of Nimrod. It's a squadron function. We've got a very specific function of training ab initio air crew, so guys brand new to the aircraft, to make sure they have the skill sets to progress in their future careers with the US Navy. So it's very comparable to what we're used to and what we know very, very well.
And how long would it take up to kind of train somebody then from just going into the Navy or RAF in future to be a
a TACO or a sort of an operator in the back?
The training time taken for an individual can vary with so many different factors, but we're probably looking at comparable times from what we understood with Nimrod to train our operators, our weapon systems officers and our pilots. The time frame shouldn't be too much difference once we've got the training established and the infrastructure in place.
Yeah. And what about the... obviously, you know, this has got two engines. Nimrod's had four.
They
had four. You're not kind of slightly worried then of flying around low on the, over the sea with...
As I mentioned before, the four engines against two engines concept, I think you need to look at a little bit in the wider picture.
Yeah.
These are hugely efficient engines, hugely reliable and modern technology. For me, as an operator in the back of the aircraft, it really doesn't cross my mind.
Yeah. What's the ride like down low as well?
Fantastic. This aircraft is thoroughly stable. It's comfortable to ride in. The mission set's not affected by where we operate from 200 feet up to the top of the operating envelope. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And the other thing I noticed is you've got a patch there with a, I'm not entirely sure, but there was a competition that was won in the US of maritime patrol crews. I think a UK Sea Corn crew came top.
The competition you're alluding to is what the US Navy call it, the ASW Rodeo. So every year they bring together their most exceptional crews together.
Yeah.
In 2014, the UK, as part of the Sea Corn issue, were invited to put a crew forward. And we were lucky enough to win that competition that year.
So you weren't sort of sent to Coventry or told not to enter again?
No, we were not sent to Coventry, aside from the usual professional banter and exploitation opportunities that were provided. It was a good win for the UK. It was an excellent win for the UK.
So, I mean, this week it's been dominated by big news on Monday. People have been, you know, a long time in coming, filling the capability gap that we need. Will you be coming back then as part of the rest of your sort of Seacon crew then to form the Nucleus in 2019?
After Monday's announcements, obviously now we can stop looking backwards and we can look forwards. And I think we're all as a collective know this is where the work starts now. So we will start to come back to the UK once the RAF wants us back in the UK to fly the P-8 in the UK.
Yeah. Excellent. Well...
What about your career? Because to find yourself working with... the Americans, you've talked about the Nimrod. Can you just tell us, for some of our younger listeners and for those thinking of coming into the services, what your career path was?
Yeah, I never envisaged myself to be operating for such a long time with a fellow nation flying their maritime patrol aircraft. So yeah, that has been a step change. That probably happened relatively late in my career. So I joined the Royal Air Force when I was 20 as a young man. I'm sure that hopefully 20-year-olds listening to this now may be interested in looking at this. Take it from me, this aircraft is fantastic. It holds a whole host of career opportunities for anyone young enough to come in and want to join the Royal Air Force and fly this fantastic aircraft.
Okay, thanks very much, Joe.
Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Hello, I'm Squadron Leader Mark Folds. I'm an instructor pilot on VP-30 FRS, which is the Fleet Replacement Squadron, like the conversion unit. In the last 4 years, I've been teaching US Navy pilots and Australian pilots to convert onto the P-8 Poseidon.
Right, so how did you convert to the P-8?
So, my career, I joined the Air Force in 1990. In the last couple of jobs, I was a Nimrod Mark II QFI, so Qualified Flying Instructor. I was also an instructor at the Nimrod MRA-4 as a project pilot there for a couple of years. Prior to that, I was the boss of Wales University Air Squadron down in St Athan in South Wales. And then the call came through in February 2012, do I want to go to Jacksonville to convert onto the P-8A, which I did.
Was that a difficult decision?
It was and it wasn't. I had a really good time at the University Air Squadron, and teaching young undergraduates to fly and send them off solo is something I'll never ever forget. So it was a tough decision, and we enjoyed living in Wales as well. But going to Jacksonville has been amazing. I converted onto the aeroplane. When I got there, we didn't have many instructor pilots and not many aeroplanes back in 2012, 2013. So I did a type rating, a 737-800 type rating in Dallas. I then came back and converted onto the P-8. And the way that it works is you become a PPC, so a patrol plane commander, they call it. It's like a P1 in our Royal Air Force speak, which means you can then sign for the aeroplane. So at the time, you had to have done 50 hours in the aeroplane, and then off you go with your mate in the other seat. Quite a joy to be afforded that opportunity as a British person flying a US Navy aeroplane, and it's a couple of million dollars. So to fly that around the continental US and down Florida to Key West was something I won't forget either.
So just going back then, what's the difference between the 737-800 and the P-8 in terms of actual flying?
So actual flying the P-8, the P-8's a 737-800 body and 900 wings, but it flies very similarly. The only experience I have with flying the 737 is in the simulator, and the simulators are so good these days that I'd like to think that it's exactly the same as this airplane. It's quite a long airplane, so you have to be quite careful when you get airborne that you don't strike the tail, but that's just all through training, and we train the guys and girls to be gentle and take off. But that's not to say that there's anything wrong with the airplane. At all, flies beautifully manually. She's really nice to fly at low level, at a couple hundred feet and a few hundred knots.
What sort of challenges does that have with this type of aircraft? Because obviously we're not familiar with seeing aircraft of this size and shape flying that low. What challenges as a pilot does that place on you?
You just have to be on your guard. The airplane's really stable at low level. Because of the way the wings are, it's quite a nice, almost bouncy ride, but not in a bad way. It's a very comfortable ride. And really, you have to keep looking outside. If you're over the sea at 200 feet, you have to have a pretty good idea of where you're going and what's happening. And the P-8, it's like when you flew the Nimrod at low level, and I guess it's the same for the P-3 guys and the French Atlantiques. You've just got to be thinking ahead all the time and what's the next move and where you're going to go and all that sort of stuff. So it's definitely got challenges, but from a pilot's perspective, flying a large airplane at low level over the sea is very, very good fun. And we don't do it because it's just good fun. We have to do it tactically as well.
What sort of mission profiles are you trained to undertake then?
So the P-8 is going to be used mission profile-wise, anti-submarine warfare, surface surveillance and search and rescue. And really, you know, what we used to do in the Nimrod, what the guys do in the P-3, it's kind of similar stuff. It's just a newer aircraft. And really, this airplane is at the cutting edge of technology. The mission system's second to none. The air vehicle's really, really good. So I think as a package, it brings a lot to, you know, it's going to bring a lot to the security for Britain.
And we're in this cockpit. It's very impressive from a novice's point of view and from a private pilot's point of view. It looks very sophisticated. How different is this from the aircraft that you've flown before?
How different is this from the aircraft I've flown before? Nimrod MRE-4 was kind of similar. We had another two MFD, or multifunction displays. But not too different. If an airline pilot from, I don't know, British Airways or something came in who had flown 737, came and sat here, he or she would be quite familiar with this. Well, there's a few different bits and pieces. Obviously, we've got a tactical display, which allows the pilot to have really good increased SA or a situational awareness. So the joy of this airplane is that you really feel part of the crew, and I, as a pilot, can be hopefully influential, but we can work as a team. If we're fighting a fight, so I'm not just, as some people would say, a bus driver. I really get involved in a tactical fight as well, which for me is kind of exciting.
And how does that work? Is there a mission commander that you're working with in the back, as it were?
Yeah, so a pilot can be a mission commander, or one of the TACOs, one of the tactical coordinators, can be a mission commander. It just depends on that individual's experience and the makeup of the crew on the day. On the FRS, on the Fleet Replacement Squadron, we do sort of basic tactics. We're not doing the frontline stuff. That's left to frontline squadrons, but we train up the individuals in the front and the back to meet that requirement.
What's your role moving forward then? Fantastic decision this week, or formalised. We've been seeing it for a while. What's the future look like for you?
Utterly exciting. It's been 4 years of hard work, and not least of all my guys in Seed Corn, of which there's 11 of us in Jacksonville. There are 9 guys up in Pax River. We've got Seed Corners in New Zealand, Australia, and Canada as well. So those guys have all been working quite hard. But the support we've got from back home, from our colleagues in MOD and the Air Force, has been it all came to fruition on Monday morning. A lot of smiling. And yes, we were there, you know, shaking the Prime Minister his hand. But really, you know, that betrays the fact that there's so many other people, not in the background, but in the foreground as well, that have brought this to happen. So as a flight commander on Seed Corn, what my job now is to make sure that when we start to transition British crews in the not-too-distant future, that is as seamless as possible. And really working with our US Navy colleagues who have been fantastically supportive in the last 4 years. And I can't see how that support would get any better. because they've been great. But given the decision on Monday, I think it's going to be even better. So really exciting times ahead. Really exciting.
I think that point's quite interesting because we're on the aircraft. There's Australian crews, American crews, British crews, but it doesn't feel any different. It feels very homogenous. It feels very collective. Everyone feels and knows what's going on. How's that been for you to work in that multinational crew?
It's been great working with multinational guys. You know, before I came across to America, I wasn't sure how it would go, how would we fit into the squadron, how would we integrate, would they be receptive to us, but really pleasantly surprised. We've been accepted and really woven into the fabric on VP30, and it's been great. Because my guys are all quite experienced, they've really been afforded lots of opportunities that perhaps wouldn't have been in the past. So I've got guys in weapons school, I've got guys working a lot of projects in VP30, so we're just like US Navy guys, albeit you can see we wear British flying suits and we've got the Union Jack on there, so that's kind of important as well. But yeah, it's been a really good time working with the Americans.
And going to miss America?
Yes, Florida is nice and warm. I have to say it's been 90 plus because they use Fahrenheit, so it's in the upper 30s and in proper Celsius. It gets humid in the summertime, but that's not a complaint. But the weather factor out there is something else. It's wonderful.
Bit different in Lossiemouth. What differences are there in flying in sort of weather conditions that I suppose we're more familiar with?
Yeah, not much really. I mean, in Florida in the summertime, around about 2 o'clock every day, that's when the thunderstorms bubble up, and you get them for a couple of 3 hours. So an airplane has got a very good capability for flying in bad weather. We try and avoid it, obviously, but were we to get caught in something anti-icing wise, we can get out of it pretty quickly. The weather radar is an excellent weather radar, and I've used that a lot in Florida. So, I mean, you know, we do get some nasty winds in Florida, so we get some nasty winds in Scotland. I guess the rain factor in Britain's a little bit greater. But that aside, I can't see there being any huge differences or any sort of challenges with operating in the British weather.
Well, we welcome you home. Looking forward to you guys flying for us.
Yeah, looking forward to it as well. And yeah, it's been quite a week so far. I wake up each morning, the last couple of mornings, and sort of pinch myself and say, did that really happen on Monday? It was quite a day. So it's not an opportunity that is afforded in your lifetime that often.
Well, thank you very much for your service.
Thank you, and great to chat.
Hello, good to meet you. My name is Nino Judge, and I'm the chairman of Flypop.
Hello, I'm Graham Howard, and I'm chief operating officer of Flypop.
Now, Nino, can I come to you first? Who came up with this crazy idea to start a new airline?
It wasn't my fault. It actually was my fault. And what it is that I'm a British Sikh, and I have many Gujarati relatives. 100% of them have always wanted to fly non-stop back home to where they come from, i.e. Amritsar in Punjab or Ahmedabad in Gujarat. And 0% have ever flown non-stop. I mean, that's incredible. In the last 40 years since the community's been in this country, we've never been able to fly non-stop from our new home to our old home. My parents had to go through Tashkent once, another time through Almaty to get to Amritsar, and I thought, why don't the legacy carriers do it? I had no answers. I'm not really an aviation man. You know, I have an aeronautical engineering degree, but then I've been working in banking, finance, and Formula One. Fortunately, I was living next to the aviation specialist I've wanted to meet all my life. And that's where it basically came together, is when I asked the same questions of Graham, saying, listen, we've got to be able to serve this VFR community. I didn't even know what VFR was, of course. You know, I want to fly home. My parents want to fly home non-stop. And they can't. From the UK to Punjab and Gujarat. So there's 500,000 Sikhs who want to fly into Punjab. And there's about 900,000 Gujaratis. Patels who live in the UK don't want to go through Mumbai. They want to go to Ahmedabad. And the Sikhs don't want to go via Delhi or Tashkent. They want to go straight home to Punjab.
So, Graham, what was your view then when across the fence he mentioned this to you?
Well, I certainly did contribute the VFR expression, which, unlike what you will know, visual flight rules is visiting friends and relatives.
Okay.
And I contributed that acronym to the project. I was very taken with the proposition. Nina hasn't talked much about the charitable dimension, but he did also have that vision right from the beginning, and I felt quite fired up by it, and so I sat down and thought about it and really wrote it down, and continued to do that over a period of 3 years, and constantly refine and research and talk to other people. I'm no expert in starting airlines. I'm no expert in airlines, but I know quite a lot about it, and I've existed in the environment for nearly 50 years. So I'm really, I know the vocabulary, and I know people who do have those skills, do have that knowledge, and I've referred to them a lot.
Right. Now, this is an airline with a difference, and you claim several firsts, don't you? You know. So, apart from the craziness of starting a new airline, tell me about why POP is going to be different. And what does POP stand for, by the way?
So POP, we thought long and hard. It took us 3 years to actually come up with a name that reflected our USPs. And finally, we came up with people over profit. And that is the essence of what we're trying to do. We're trying to put the people, the customer, society, above our bottom line, the profit. I sincerely believe that there is going to be enough bottom line, but we don't have to take it all.
But you want to donate 51% of your net profits. Let's just say we get to the point where you're making a net profit. This is not an industry renowned for making money, particularly with startups. But you've made a commitment for 51% of your net profits to go to charities and the communities that you serve. Tell us a little bit about why you've decided to do that and who these charities are.
Right, so the way I look at it is that business needs to sustain society and it needs to sustain the planet. Business is the biggest, almost the biggest force on Earth. Everyone has the yearning to make money. And I think everyone has the yearning also to help society. But it's just not been married for a long time. I think for the last 3 or 4 decades, those two things have diverged. And all I'm trying to do is restart a business model, which we call caring capitalism, where society is looked after from our net profits. So this is not from our gross profits. So we will still be reinvesting in the business to make it grow. And we'll still be, you know, giving out performance bonuses to declare the net profit. But once those net profits are declared, and we're hoping, you know, to have a net profit in year two, 51% of those net profits will go to good causes. Now, that might only be £2.50, but hopefully one day it'll be £2.5 million, and another year it might be £25 million, right? I think you have to start somewhere.
What sort of community organisations are we talking about here?
Mostly we want to support children and women, the hungry, the underprivileged, in the UK and where we fly to. I mean, I'm a British Sikh, so charity begins at home. We want to do, there's as many homeless people, you know, here as there are in India. So both communities need to be nurtured from our profits. Yep. So we've picked charities that are really to do with children. Railway children. I think what it says on the tin. You know, there's poor kids who basically run away from home or get lost and they hang around railways. You know, then they get educated with a charity called Pratam, which is children's education. You know, and then we have Skillforce in the UK, which is absolutely inspirational. Being ex-armed forces myself, I think those guys do an amazing job, and they're fantastic at motivating kids, you know, especially with disabilities. And then we've got, you know, the very amazing charity called Dreams Come True for children, who are for terminally ill children who need, you know, who at least we can make one of their final dreams come true, and that'd be, you know, taking a flight to somewhere gorgeous where we can treat them.
Now, that's not all you claim to do. Apart from starting this airline and apart from giving something back, you're also going to attempt to be carbon neutral, the world's first carbon neutral airline. Graham, how in goodness name are you going to do that?
We've taken advice from professional consultants who work in the field. The cost of doing it isn't huge. It isn't huge. It isn't life-threatening to an airline. But airlines tend to only make a gesture towards it rather than to go the whole hog.
So how will POP be different then?
Well, POP will merely spend what it takes. But we've got the we know the aircraft type that we plan to operate. We know what its carbon creation is, so to speak. And we've taken advice on what it will cost per passenger on the services. Now, all this needs validating, but at the present moment, we're confident that even if we had to put a small supplement on our airfares, a fiver a fare, would you fly for an extra fiver on top of maybe £450? I think you would. Most people would. And so, we're not quite concluded whether there will be a visible, in the way that in times gone by there was a security supplement or a fuel cost supplement when there were crises in the world, maybe there'll be a small carbon supplement, but it won't be an option. Where it is an option these days, where Lufthansa will whomever, why would I name them, all the big carriers will say you can offset your flight by giving us another £20 or something. Well, no, we won't be making it optional, but we will make it visible what it costs, and people will know that they're doing that, and we'll make the calculation visible as well.
So here we've got a great idea, we've got some fantastic initiatives, unseen and unheard of in the airline industry. How are you now going about setting this airline up? The infrastructure, the financing, and I'll come back to the aircraft because I'm sure some of our listeners will want to know what you're going to fly. How are you going about now setting this up?
Right. So my job primarily is to find the financing. Right. So we've launched a crowdfunding appeal to raise £5 million. Each gold pass, we call it, is £500. We are trying to sell 10,000 of those, which would raise us the £5 million. We need a minimum of 7,000, and the gold benefits, I don't know if you know about them, they're absolutely fantastic. It's almost like having a VIP membership for 5 years, and you have a free ticket thrown in anyway, so it's not a bad deal.
It's crowdfunding surely is not going to be the only way that you're going to be able to finance this.
I might have put that second along.
Right.
EIS.
Well, exactly. So, the crowdfunding is something we've already we've announced, okay. But really behind the scenes, we have a EIS where we're trying to raise £5 million with investors.
Enterprise investment scheme. It's a government scheme which gives tax breaks to the investor.
Right.
It's a fantastic scheme. So we're raising £5 million with that. Yeah. So we have an approved scheme from HMRC.
Yeah.
Which the features of an EIS are whatever money you put in, you get 30% back as a tax credit.
Right. Okay.
So it's a fantastic scheme by the government, which incentivizes high net worth individuals, etc., to invest in riskier businesses.
Yeah.
Right. So we are pretty well progressed on that.
Right. Okay.
We were hoping actually to announce something by this weekend, but it's taken a little bit longer as these things do when you have Brexit. Exactly. Exactly. So, so that's basically trying to raise £10 million to get the show on the road.
Right. Okay. So we talked money. We talked about the culture, the idea, the concepts. Let's talk about the timetable now.
Yeah.
What's the timetable for making this happen?
The timetable. Our initial timetable was fourth quarter this year. And partly because we wanted to capture, probably driven by what we perceived to be market opportunity more than practicality. But we'd got people saying, in 3 months I can do this, in 3 months I can do that. The reality, I think, is sinking in that in 3 months they won't do that and they can't do that. And so in pretty much absolute probability it's going to slip into next year. We would hope.
But Graham, that is a monumental challenge to make this happen in such a short space of time, is it not?
Inside 12 months from now, well inside 12 months from now, this airline will fly.
Okay.
Otherwise, it will never fly. But it will fly in that time. So what we have to do, there are various ways in which we can be licensed. There are various ways in which we can contract our aircraft, as you know, and contract air crew and the rest of it. We're wading through a lot of proposals on that, trying to get the most economic, but also trying to get the fastest track to do it, because we know that if we start in one way, we will have to morph the organisation into another form of organisation. Airline operator certificate is a big feature of that. And we will have to be a real airline, and we plan to be that.
So we've talked about the infrastructure and the financing and that sort of thing. There's branding that's coming together, you're building your presence on social media. That's all starting to fall together. Let's talk about the routes. Where do you want to fly to? And then we'll talk about how you're going to do it, what equipment we're going to look to use.
Yeah. So the routes are fundamental to what we're doing. And it's from the southern part of the United Kingdom, because that's where our Asian community mostly live, to Amritsar in Punjab,
direct,
non-stop, and to Ahmedabad, which is about 6 to 8 hours north of Mumbai. And that's where the Gujarati community primarily come from. And of course, Amritsar from Delhi is about a 12-hour drive.
Okay, I wouldn't know that, but take your word for it.
It's big. It's big.
It's not a nice 12-hour drive.
It can be quite stressful, especially for the elderly, you know, who really want to, you know, go back home as many times a year as they can. You know, and that's what we're really trying to say to them is, now you can.
Yeah.
So you can go back more than once every 2 years because you feel a bit fragile.
Yeah.
You know, it's 8 hours. It's nothing.
And have you got a price point?
We've schemed this, planned it, if you like, modelled it on what we call a charter-style fare structure, where you have bands of fares, and I'll use figures, 350 to 750, let's say, and you have a different number, different according to the season, according to the competitive situation, according to the demand. You vary the number of seats available in each band and move to the more expensive band. So you are yield managing in the way that an airline currently yield manages, but you're not running an algorithm which has got such complexity that today it can offer you a fare to any of these cities for £400 and tomorrow it could be £1,800 because some parameter in the algorithm has triggered a really extreme change. So we're trying to keep it simple because we think that's part of the appeal, that we can say there are three more seats available at this price and then it will go to £400. Whatever. But in the peak period, there won't be many of those £350 seats, I can assure you, but there will be some. And so we will be able to save from there to there, but we will not have the extreme and what we would call unfairs up there in the £1,000 plus for an economy seat.
And of course... Just, sorry, Nina.
Just to reiterate on that, the Asian community is the most price-sensitive community, right? And that's putting it kindly.
And that's a part of the world that's growing low-cost airlines quicker than the shape of the
air. Exactly. So what we want to be is we need to be competitive. And in fact, one of the things I asked Graham to do before we wasted each other's time was, if we can't put this proposition on at the right price point, we're wasting our time. Because it's not a premium service they want. They want a good value service, which is where which is where Graham coined the phrase enhanced value. So it's not quite low cost, and it's not premium.
What about this service then? What sort of service offerings are you planning? Food? What's going on?
Well,
food will be paid for on board. The main meal will be paid for on board. Like Norwegian, you know, not a crazy model. Or people could bring their own. But we will supply basic snacks. We will supply all hot drinks and soft drinks and the like. But people will be able to buy enhancements to that. They'll get a considerably higher baggage allowance because that's a market driver in the Indian market in particular.
So you're not going to charge for baggage?
Not beyond, but they'll get two bags at 23 kilos.
Okay.
Thereafter,
yeah,
we'll,
sure,
we'll be charging, of course. But we've coined this phrase, enhanced value, in order to differentiate us from full service or low cost at the two extremes. We're living somewhere in there with elements, but we say, right, we're flying non-stop services, major reductions in overall journey times, you know, from 9-hour block hours to 18 hours, rather, down to 9 block hours. But we want our passengers and competitors to see us as good value, as fair, rational in our approach, safe, competent, clean and comfortable, and offering on-time, thoughtful, friendly service. And if we can tick all those boxes, we've got a product.
And, of course, our listeners will want to know, coming from Farnborough, what the aircraft you are planning to operate this service with. And, you know, given the length of service, there's probably not too many choices out there, but I'm sure you've got your eye on something. What are you looking at?
We do. At the present moment, our planning surrounds the A330-300. Whether that will come true at the end of the day, who knows? But we can get as near the 400 seats as we're targeting in an all-economy configuration, perhaps with one cabin with enhanced legroom, maybe 80 seats with increased legroom. And we want to get as near 400 seats as we can because we've modelled around that number, 378, if I'm precise. And, you know, finding an aircraft that's in this configuration is obviously a challenge as well because so many of the used aircraft are in three class.
So you talk about finding the aircraft. You're looking for a single aircraft or are you looking for multi-aircraft? Are you leasing?
The plan, we will lease. For sure we'll lease, and it'll be a very wet lease to start with because we have no intention of recruiting our own pilots, buying airplanes, zipping off and all around the place, making contracts for catering or for ground handling or whatever. We have to get us a fairly consolidated service initially and then slowly take on elements of that service as we develop as an organisation, and we have every intention of doing that because it will be more economic to do it ourselves rather than buy a package. But yes, so we start packaged and we slowly change that package as the organisation evolves.
This is a fantastic initiative. I feel quite passionate about it. I can feel the passion coming through you guys, and I want to wish you every success. We're going to follow your journey, though. We're going to follow you on this journey and see how you get on. So hopefully this will be the first of our sessions with you. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really love the fact that you get what we're doing.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
They're constantly refining the materials used for the heat exchanger in a large blue vacuum furnace and testing the jet and rocket engine that will power this, their space plane, Skylon.
The sort of holy grail of space flight is being together a machine that can fly into space and come back again and do it cheaply and safely and reliably. And in fact, there's been no real progress in terms of the way in which we get into space since the very start of the space age. So the actual technology we're working on is designed to solve that problem.
Although the Sabre is being designed to take us into orbit, it may usher in a new era of travel back on Earth, the hypersonic age. The LATCAT plane, as they call it, promises staggering speeds of more than 3,000 miles an hour. Put another way, flying from London to Sydney in 4 hours.
What we have to do now is build an actual running engine, and that we're planning to do by the end of the decade. And that will then hopefully destroy the, all the other naysayers that think that this can't be done.
The project received a huge boost at the end of 2015, $100 million in investment from BAE Systems and the British government. Enough, they hope, to get their dream off the ground.
When that day happens and that aeroplane rolls out on the tarmac, that will be a pretty emotional moment. I mean, my whole career will have been invested in getting to that point.
Okay, so hopefully you found that fairly informative. Richard Barvell, our chief engineer, is still with our company, still leading the technology that we're developing. And as you said at the beginning of that video, he's one of the founders of our business, along with Alan Bond as well. So we've got some real key guys that are helping to push this program forward. So really, as I mentioned about, Richard explained it so perfectly, but in terms of, you know, it is a new class of engine that we're developing. To give us hypersonic or space access. One of the key things for us is in terms of the speed, we're looking to go 5 times the speed of sound, so Mach 5, Mach 5.5, but do it from the ground and come back. So reusability is a key function for us. Now, as Richard said, there's a few naysayers out there, but we have had some independent assessments from the Air Force and from ESA in terms of its viability, and we've had some very good feedback in terms of the viability of, you know, what we can do and the technology. So that's really important to us. In terms of the company, it is a privately held company, and obviously we have, as mentioned in the video, investment from UK government and from BAE as well. So that was a huge enabler for us back in 2013 and 2015. So what is Reaction Engines? What it's made up of? So headquarters Reaction Engines, UK company based in Culham, on the Culham Fusion site. Some of you may know of it. And we're made up of a couple of different subdivisions. We now have a small division in the States, in Colorado, which we set up this year, which is quite an important activity for us to branch out in that vein. We have an assembly area, which is located in Culham as well. And then we have a couple of supporting functions. One is through Crossman, which is a fabrication company, and one through Brights, which is a high precision machine company. Really important for us in terms of being able to remain agile is to have those facilities close by and to be able to have quick turnarounds as we develop our technology. And then finally, we have a rocket testing facility, which is in Westcott in the UK. In fact, it's not very far from us. It's only about 20 miles away, so it's very, very handy. So as I mentioned, based in Culham, you'll see here we have the main engineering design centre there. We've in fact been growing pretty rapidly over the last year or so. This time last year we were probably at 50, 60 people. Now, probably by the end of August, we're going to be at 100 people. So that's pretty rapid growth in terms of bringing jobs and other things to the area. And obviously from the technology we're developing, we have a lot of people wanting to come and see what we do, and obviously maybe join us as well. So it's quite interesting. As I mentioned before, we have the manufacturing site there. Here, this large blue vacuum furnace. This is critical to our technology. It allows us to do what we call some welding type technology for our pre-cooler, which we'll come on to in a minute. And then we have a small test site there whereby we did a lot of the pre-cooler testing, which is a key technology element, and we'll go on to that in a second. As I mentioned, the advanced manufacturing facility, I already mentioned the vacuum furnace, this big blue block that we have here. We also have a small capability on 3D printing, but I also mentioned the precision machining that we have through our Brights function. So we have everything we need to be able to do, you know, make quick, rapid prototypes and develop the technology. So I mentioned what is some of our key technologies that we're developing. One is the pre-cooler. Why is this so special? As you saw in the video, this is the part of the engine that allows us to cool the air extremely rapidly from 1,000 degrees down to minus 150 degrees. Why do we want to do that? Because then we can put that air into a conventional combustion type chamber system. So we do that through, we use a helium as a cooling medium, but it is unique technology that we developed and is really, as I say, at the core of our engine development. So, as you can imagine, this is the whole Sabre engine. What does it hold for the future for us? Well, it could be in a number of areas. Mentioned the next generation of space access, but we also have obviously the hypersonic, the age of the hypersonic travel, which again, that engine could allow that to happen. So there's a number of vehicles we could look at using that engine on, and obviously the engine is the key part to it. So I'll hand you over to Philippa just to give you a quick overview of the performance.
Yeah, so I'm going to take you through a little bit about how the engine performs and its capability relative to some of the other existing propulsion systems that you might be familiar with. So one of the key things, we're going to take this engine from zero on the end of the runway up to Mach 5 and half in air breathing mode. And the image on the left here, the graph, represents its fuel efficiency, so specific impulses on the y-axis there, and that represents the fuel efficiency of that engine. And what you can see is it's fairly flat across the whole of that air breathing Mach number range, which is obviously critical to being able to achieve a really fuel efficient engine. We also have modularised this engine, which enables us to test it on a ground-based testbed very rigorously to really develop the technology. So that's one of the key aspects of a Sabre engine cycle, which is to enable it to be tested on a ground test bed rather than a lot of the existing propulsion systems, which either need very expensive wind tunnels or flight test vehicles to be able to achieve similar levels of development. So this, there's two charts here. The one on the left represents the fuel efficiency and its comparison of the Sabre engine against existing types of propulsion systems. You can see things like your traditional turbojet, which is obviously incredibly efficient, but only gives you capability up to about Mach 2.5, Mach 3. And what we need to achieve is up to Mach 5.5 to get a single stage to orbit vehicle. So that's the blue line is turbojet, and then you can see some of the other technologies like ramjet and scramjet on this curve. A rocket, a conventional rocket system is very fuel inefficient, and that's the grey line on the bottom. The Sabre engine incorporates the capability of the two, so you're trying to take the fuel efficiency of a traditional jet engine up to as high a Mach number as possible before you have to convert into a rocket system. On the right, we've got a curve of thrust weight ratio, again, against Mach number. Again, because we've got an integrated system, so we're taking the best components of a jet engine, the best components of a rocket, we get a really good thrust weight ratio, which enables us to sort of maximise the capability across from ground all the way up to orbit, or in any of the other options as well, so high Mach number flight operation. As I mentioned before, it's quite a modularised system, so you can break it down into three key elements. The main heat exchangers at the front of the engine, so that's the pre-cooler that Mark mentioned. We've done a lot of testing of that at our test facility to prove that works. We've taken it from ambient down to near to minus 150 in steady state operation. The next thing to do is that to take that up to 1,000 degrees centigrade and prove the technology. Again, that can be done in isolation. The core system in the centre, that can be tested on this ground-based test facility, and we can really test its operation from equivalent of zero to Mach 5 on a ground test facility. And then we've got combustion chambers and nozzles. And again, we've been actively looking at nozzle systems for the last decade because we want systems that operate from ground all the way up to space. And multiple times, one of the things about the Sabre engine is it's got multi-use, so whereas a lot of space propulsion systems these days are single-use systems, this has multi-use. So here are some images of a lot of the rocket testing that we've done. We use this facility over at Westcott, and we have tested all sorts of advanced nozzles to accommodate the altitude difference from ground to high altitude.
Okay, so we mentioned earlier about some of the key program funding and key partners. As mentioned in the video and a couple of times, made up of our historic investment has come from private investment, somewhere in the order of 50 million, but over the last couple of years, we've been very successful in terms of achieving UK government funding to the tune of about 60 million, and then obviously the additional funding from BAE last year of 20 million. So, you know, we've been doing well. We've come from a very, very good beginning. The company was started back in 1989, and gradually from that private investment now to a larger scale investment is helping us on our development path. So, key partners with the Air Force Research Laboratory, as I mentioned earlier, obviously UK Space Agency, ESA, and obviously critically with BAE in 2015. Okay, so that gives you, hopefully gives you a quick flavour of who we are, what we do, why we're so passionate about what we do, and why we enjoy it so much. Open to questions, really.
Okay, the type of the US and the you know, you've got the US office now, and you've got the Air Force Research Lab interested. So, is that going to bring up any ITAR challenges in the future if they start working with you on it?
Yeah.
And secondly, when it was first announced, and I think it was the Royal Society, and there was a big sort of press conference there about potential other applications. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it was also mentioned was how you could use the pre-cooler to make current jet engines more efficient. Is there work still going on that?
Yes, so let me answer in two parts. So the first question regarding ITAR, and obviously any work that, NOAA and other institutions in the States, we're very, very conscious of ITAR. That's in fact one of the areas that, you know, we're getting support from BAE, in fact, but we're very conscious of making sure that, you know, we keep this technology and we don't end up having it being ITAR. So, you know, we have a segregated area within our business and, you know, comms and all the other sort of things you need to put in place as a sort of governance, corporate governance, to manage that type of activity. In terms of the pre-cooler, you're correct. There are a number of applications. One of the things that, from a pre-cooler testing, there's nothing to say that, you know, we may do the pre-cooler, the hot heat exchange testing that Philippa was alluding to. We would probably do that in Europe and probably in the US as well. We could, you know, it's able to be segregated. We need to go, you know, where the facilities and the labs are correct. You know, getting either a high temperature or a high airflow is not a simple matter. We don't have those facilities, so we will have to go and use facilities elsewhere. But clearly, the pre-cooler technology is something that could be used in traditional gas turbine systems potentially and other applications.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Hi, my name is John Tugas. I'm a Boeing test pilot. I fly the F-18 Super Hornet, and I'm also a retired Navy commander.
John, thank you very much for joining us on Extended. I know you've got a very busy week here. Now, you're flying in the displays this week. Not today. We've got you for a little time. Can you tell us about the preparation for preparing for a display like Farnborough?
Okay, well, it's a lot longer than people would realize. It's probably about 6 weeks start to finish. And the flying doesn't even start until about week four. So there's a lot of analysis that goes into what type of display we want to put on. So this year, we decided we're going to show the aircraft flying with 8 air-to-air missiles, which is a very robust combat loadout. So now we start the analysis. Okay, put the weapons on the aircraft. Now try to work, create a script that's going to show the capabilities and the handling qualities mainly of an airplane that's fully loaded. So that's about a week's worth of engineering analysis. We have our team consists of a doctorate in aerospace engineering. We get in the simulators. We practice multiple maneuvers. And so once we have the maneuvers we want, then we try to stitch them together. Much like an ice skater would do a routine, we try to smoothly stitch them together. We try to comply with the time constraints. This year, our time constraint was 8 minutes.
Right.
So fit them all in 8 minutes. And then this year, unique to this year, was the ability to try to fit this in a very, very small airspace boundary. The airspace boundary is about 1,500 meters across by about 1,500 meters wide. So it's a very tight space.
Right, okay.
So that takes 1 week. Then simulators will take 2 weeks. Okay, so the first part of the simulator is just, again, getting used to the routine and rehearsing it. We actually import the Google Earth imagery of the airfield we go to, and then we lay out the airspace boundaries in these very brightly colored lines so we can see exactly where we need to place the maneuvers. And then we rehearse the routine to the point where we have it memorized backwards and forwards. And then the last week, it's check ride week. So we have our chief pilot come in. He'll grade everything. He'll time everything. And he wants to see consistency and safety. So what that means is at any moment during a routine, we could lose an engine. We have to be able to demonstrate we can safely recover. We could lose a flight control service. We have to safely recover. We could get hit by birds. We have to safely recover. And so that's the rigor that goes into this air show. It'd be easy if all we had to do is just come into the air show, fly a bunch of maneuvers, and exit. But you can see there's a lot of engineering rigor and mental rehearsal that goes into this.
And we're aware historically in the UK of why the box is so much smaller. What sort of pressures does that put on you as a pilot in such a constricted space?
There is a lot of pressure to comply with all the rules because the violation results in the discontinuing of the show and you basically get disinvited. So coming from a military background, used to operating under pressure where you really don't get a second chance, failure's not an option, that's why it took 5 weeks to get here. We practice it, we do the flying part, like I said, in week four we start the flying part, and it's not until week six that we're able to consistently place all our maneuvers, and these are three-dimensional high dynamic high g-force maneuvers, consistently place them over a spot in the ground. We're getting to the point where we're hitting about plus or minus 100 meters on our spots. Every minute of every day, you got different winds and different conditions. It's probably the same pressure that Andy Murray had when he stepped onto the court a week ago.
And all that preparation goes into an 8 minute slot and then it's done. What sort of physical pressures will you experience in the cockpit for the display?
We will pull maximum G-force, which is about 7.5 times the force of gravity. So, I'm 80 kilograms. I can't do that math in public, but you get heavy quick. But you also have an adrenaline rush. And you have anti-G protection, so I have a G suit on me that acts like a blood pressure cuff to prevent my blood from pulling down in the lower extremities. And it is an intense physical workout, and you sleep really well at night. So I come out of the cockpit drained. I step down the ladder. My life support guy hands me a bottle of water. By the time I walk upstairs, that bottle is gone.
Yeah.
So it is a physical experience, but it's an adrenaline rush. So for adrenaline junkies and people that like to do things physical, you can't beat it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Very, very jealous from that point of view. My colleague flew backseat with I think one of your colleagues a few years ago from here, so experienced some of that. Tell us about the aircraft that you're going to fly.
The F-18 Super Hornet is a twin-tailed, twin-engine Navy fighter. It's the first stealth fighter that the Navy bought, and it's a huge upgrade from the previous its predecessor, which is the Hornet. This one's much bigger, much more capable, carries more. And the nice thing about having twin tails, twin engines, you've got the confidence and reliability to maneuver that aircraft anywhere you want without worrying about getting yourself into trouble, in an unrecoverable situation.
Right, okay.
So,
okay. And the performance of the aircraft?
We've been up to past 1.8 Mach, okay, so from here to London in about 3 minutes. We've also been up to 50,000 feet, and maybe I stretched that a couple times, but it's certified to 50,000 feet. We're carrying close to 16,000 pounds of bombs. It can carry up to 29,000 pounds of fuel. and we're going to burn maybe, you know, we're going to burn burn through that fuel more you carry. But the whole idea was we can put our carriers anywhere on Earth, and there's no targets we can't reach with that aircraft and its weapon system. The magic is mostly stuff I can't talk about, but the magic sensors, the magic radar, you've got what I call R2-D2 on board to protect you. So lots of computers that are talking to each other, telling you who's looking at you, who's a threat, and they help you decide what to do. So you really feel confident going into combat in this jet.
Right, okay. And what's John doing when he's not flying displays at Farnborough?
I'll fly production flights out of St. Louis where these aircraft are manufactured. So after they've been assembled, someone does engine runs and flight control checks, but I'll be the person to get it in the air for the very first time.
Right. Wow. What's that feel like? Well, a new aircraft every time.
What's nice is this aircraft, we're reaching the sweet spot of the production where all the kinks and all the wrinkles have been worked out. So you have full confidence when you release the brakes that the engines are going to work perfectly. You're going to get off the ground. The landing gear is going to go up. You're going to turn on the radar. It's going to work fine. So I've had very little excitement at all during any production flight. And so it's actually a joy. It's almost relaxing, if you will.
Okay. And you talked very briefly in the introduction about your career. Can you tell us about some of your career steps? How did you come into to fly these aircraft? Where did it all start?
Okay, so I'm probably in a small percentage of people that knew what I wanted to do from a very young age. Very first word out of my mouth was airplane. The very first drawing I ever drew as a kid was an airplane. I built all the models, all the plastic models, so it was kind of in my blood. No one in my family had flown before, but so I knew I was going to make a career out of that. Now the question was, where do I make a career? I thought airlines. I got a chance to fly with some Navy veterans that were in a demonstration team. They do a lot of maneuvers like the Blue Angels, except it was a propeller plane. They said, "Kid, what do you want to do?" I said, "I don't fly an airplane." They said, "You need to fly for the Navy." I said, "Why?" They said, "Landing in a boat at night is the hardest thing you can possibly do in an airplane." I said, "Okay, that's what I want to do." That was age 14, and much older then. But
So what aircraft are you flying in?
Well, let's see. As small as a Pitt Special, you see out here, to as large as a B-1B Lancer bomber, heavy bomber. Now I'm flying 737, the P-8, the F-18, the E-18G Growler. I have my own Bonanza. I've flown float planes, helicopters. And so that was the fun part of becoming a test pilot. Test pilots fly everything, lots of things. I've flown gliders.
And you mentioned helicopters there, and ultimately we always like to ask fixed-wing pilots what they feel about the differences between flying the whirlybirds and the things with wings. What did it mean to you?
Well, from about 10 seconds after grabbing the flight controls, I realized you have to be on your toes all the time, constantly. There's no relaxing. There's no, you know, reaching up and itching your head or anything. You have to be, there's no lollygagging at all. But it is fun to fly close to the earth, be able to stop, pedal turn. I had a test pilot school classmate of mine put his skid on a fence post and pivot around that fence post in a field. I had difficulty just staying over the field in a hover. So it was a challenge, you know, just like anything else. I like challenges.
Okay. We mentioned the Navy a few times there, and of course carriers. What's the challenges in terms of getting these aircraft up and down on the decks?
On the decks. So I don't remember my first carrier landing at all. It was a blur. I don't remember my first night landing. It was a blur. I do remember the catapult shots. So when you're launched off, it's about a 4.5 G. shoved to the back of the seat, your eyeballs almost go up the back of your head, and you're disoriented for a few milliseconds, but that is a thrill. I have never taken a cat shot and not gone, yahoo, during a cat. It's just so much fun. Landing can be nerve-wracking. I've landed in downpours like we saw here at Farnborough, and not seeing a thing. I just felt that I landed, and even after I landed, I couldn't see where to turn, but I knew it was turned to the right. So it can be nerve-wracking. But again, it's all a challenge, and if you're an adrenaline junkie, you cannot find a better rush.
Okay, and greatest memory of flying?
Greatest memory of flying had to be my first solo. It was in Atlanta, Georgia. An instructor surprised me. He says, land, do a full stop landing, pull over, and he didn't say a word. He just gets out, closes the door, and points to the runway and tells me to go. That was nerve-wracking.
Lots of pilots say that, certainly for me as well. I'm only a private pilot, but I understand that. Yeah. And, you know, at the peak of your career and certainly flying the latest and greatest, what words could you give to some youngsters maybe thinking about coming into service or to the flight industry?
Coming into service, you know, I always said I'm going to stay in as long as it's fun, and 20 years went by in a flash. So I think it's the, you know, flying these fantastic high-performance machines is indescribable. And when you go to an air show and you look at those machines, and you say, that's what I want to do, make that your goal. And I taped a picture of an airplane all over my room and stared at that goal until I reached it. So I would say get something you can look at every day and then look at every day until you reach that goal.
John, thank you very much for joining us and have a fantastic show.
Sure. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ed Wilson. I'm the chief pilot for the 737, including the MAX aircraft, for the Boeing company.
Okay, and welcome to Aviation Extended. We're here at the Farm Air Show 2016, where we've got the rare privilege of speaking to Boeing here. They're celebrating their 100th anniversary this week, and one of the things they brought is the 737 MAX, which is being demoed by Chief Test Pilot Ed Wilson. Ed, welcome to Extended.
Well, thank you.
So the MAX, latest in the 737, classic design. What's the MAX like to fly?
MAX is very similar to the previous generation, the NG, so it's we have new engines and new displays in the flight deck, but other than that, the average pilot will not even notice a difference.
So all the changes are sort of aimed at the efficiency of the engines and also the sort of situation awareness of the cockpit. Is that right?
Yes, that's primarily it. The engines will improve the performance, the fuel range capability of the airplane, and the flight deck will now have cleaner displays, much easier commonality across all the Boeing fleet, and also a little bit of reconfigurability for someone who wants to change their displays a little bit around.
And also, you've got on a recognition point for all the aircraft spotters out there, you've got those sexy winglets on there, which are made by GKN Aerospace, one of the suppliers for it. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what do they do?
Well, effectively, they... as any winglet, they help extend the aspect ratio or the not too technical anyway, they improve the efficiency of the airplane by about 1.8% for those winglets alone.
Okay. And for your display here at the Farm Air Show, so Boeing's only just recently started displaying airliners at air shows. So what does your display involve? What are you going to be showing off?
Primarily, it's all about just showing the crowd the airplane, the silhouette of the aircraft, and showing a little bit of its performance capabilities as you wouldn't expect an airline to do. So you're a nice aggressive climb to demonstrate a little of the power of the engines that yep, and then some maneuvering. In this case, we show that the airplane has new electronic spoilers, and they give it a nice roll, easy, crisp roll response, and then just let you have a view of the airplane as it flies by.
Excellent. And how long does it sort of take to prepare it? What kind of sort of training or preparation goes into sort of a display at Farnborough?
So there's a lot of preparation that goes into it because it's not easy to do the maneuvers and keep them within the airspace. So we first get the layout of the airspace and the requirements that the air show puts upon us to ensure we're safe while we're operating here. We go into a layout a few plans in the on paper, and then we go into a simulator and we attempt to fly those. We had keeping in mind all the restrictions for altitudes. Just this year, they changed the airspace in and around Farnborough, so it became a little bit more difficult to fit what our classic maneuvers would have been. So try them on paper, go 4 or 5 hours in the simulator trying them, and then out to an airplane where you work in the aircraft, working your way from a little bit higher altitude, a little bit safer altitude, working your way down to where you're closer to the ground, where it'd be more pleasing display for the crowds.
Okay. And just thinking about the obviously your day job is not sort of pleasing the public at air shows, but the serious flight test. So tell us how's that's going, because you guys are actually almost a little bit ahead of schedule, if I'm correct, and maybe getting the aircraft out to customers early.
Yes, we're doing very well in our flight test program. We started flight testing with the first airplane in January 29th of this year. We now have four airplanes in test. The one here at Farnborough is the number four airplane. Each airplane has its specific tasks. The first aircraft we do our flying qualities, our maneuverability of the aircraft. The second airplane is more about the engines. The third airplane is more about the automatic systems on the airplane, the flying. And then the fourth airplane is all about the interior. So the one we have here has a full interior so that you can check the air conditioning, the galley layouts, how the seats are working, and sometimes even how the lavatories work in the aircraft here.
That's the official part of flight test.
Yeah. A very important part of flight test, actually.
What a great job you've got. I mean, what's your background? How did you get to be kind of a chief sort of pilot for 737?
It goes back. I started out in the U.S. Air Force. I flew fighters. I even actually came over here to the U.K. and flew fighters over here at Upper Hayford. One of my children was born over here, actually.
Okay.
So, but I went to the Air Force Test Pilot School, and then when I got out, I started flying with McDonnell Douglas, flying there, the F-15 with McDonnell Douglas, and then transitioned to the commercial about 10 years ago and started flying. We go through what we call production testing, flying the new aircraft. Off the production line, we always make sure we fly them before we give them over to the customers. And then I moved into what we call our engineering group and have just worked my way through the ranks here.
Okay. And flight tester, what do you enjoy most about the sort of flight testing? I mean, if you were to say, wow, this is kind of this is the fun part. Is there any particular bit that you enjoy?
I really enjoy it all. Yes. The opportunity to have interviews like this, getting stumped. I really enjoy it all. It's more the engineering aspect. I learn more about the airplane. It's the flying, the maneuvers. I've learned and know how to have learned those for years. Now it's learning how to apply it to a particular aircraft and how it works for, say, a 37 versus, I said, I flew F-15s. Flying an F-15 doing a similar maneuver is way different than flying in a 737. Yeah. So it's just learning that and then the engineering that goes behind and how we get to those.
So, I mean, given this vast store of knowledge about 737s, then go and tell us some, kind of 737 fun fact that almost nobody knows about.
I don't have. Everyone knows everything about a 737. There's nothing hidden. We don't hide anything about them, so there are no hidden facts on the aircraft.
A shame, disappointment.
Yeah, I don't know what to think of I would know.
Trivia about a 737 that.
No, I'm at a loss for something that's new and exciting, or a little trivia thing about the 737.
Here's a piece of trivia. So. We statistically roll out a new 7-3 out of Renton every 12 hours.
That's quite amazing. Well, you think about it. I started in Seattle flying my first 737. The as we would call it, the line number or whatever it was, the NG number 2235. The first MAX airplane is. Number 5,602, and I think we've already essentially breached the 5,900 line. So I know we're in the few years I've been flying commercial airplanes, we've built 3,500 or 3,700 737s.
That's just the NGs.
That's just the NGs, yes.
Yeah, that excludes the previous classics. But you think about it, so we're building 42 airplanes a month, going to 47, 52, and eventually 57 airplanes per month. So even at today's rate, that equates to about 2 aeroplanes a day coming off the line.
Mm-hmm. And, yep. And Ed, what other type ratings do you have? What other aircraft do you fly for Boeing and have previously flown?
Well, for Boeing, I'm type rated in all the current production aircraft. So the 747, the 767, the 777, and the 787. My biggest engineering job for the company for Boeing in the commercial world has been in the 787. I flew that for quite a bit.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then so previous to that, you go back to my Air Force days, I flew F-111s. I've flown F-15s, several other fighter aircraft, A-7s, F-4s, F-16s.
Okay. Yep. Well, the question's coming then. What's your favorite?
My answer to that is the one and always is the one I'm flying today.
Yeah. That's a nice answer. Yeah. I like that.
I don't know. I couldn't even tell you hard. I don't keep track of my hours very well anymore. I have about 5,500 hours, I guess, here.
Right. Fantastic. All right. So probably one final question to end on is... What advice would you give to kind of youngsters getting into aviation these days? Obviously 737 Max. It's efficient for the airlines. They're going to love it. But maybe they'll think, oh well, hang on, is there? You know, that's a sort of a 60s, 70s airliner. What would you say to people to young people to get them excited?
If you think about it, right now we are in a phase of in the Boeing company where we are testing new airplanes all the time. There is always flight tests that's going to go on. My biggest advice to any youngster right now is to do the math and the sciences and use that to convert into an engineering type degree or schooling, and then you open up all the possibilities for any part of an aviation world. If you get into engineering, you get to learn about it either if you're a designer and or have you ever become a pilot, and I encourage you to become a pilot. I think it's great fun. You then can become a test pilot. Okay? Don't limit yourself by not following through with those engineering type and math and science courses.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. It was great to be here.
I'm with Aram Mehta from Defence News. Aram, welcome back on Extended.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Now, since we last met a year or two ago, you won a media award, did you not?
I did, yeah. I was lucky enough and I guess bribed enough people in 2015 to win the Young Journalist Award in Paris. And I keep telling everyone that the fact that young journalists is 35 and under says a lot about our industry. But I'm not going to turn it down. It's cool. It's very cool, and it's a great honor. There's a lot of awesome people who do this job. Yeah. So it's really special that I won that.
Well, congratulations from all the team here. But we're at Farnborough. It's the end of day three. It's been very busy. What's it been like for you? What are key stories for you and for Defence News?
So the biggest one obviously happened Monday morning, the UK order coming through for the P-8 and then the Apache announcement for 50 Apaches. At air shows these days, it's largely commercial, the news. You get a lot of, we're always trying to find news. This is one of the few cases where there's a giant defense buy that actually went down. And I think that's symbolic in a lot of ways, because the overriding issue everyone's talking about is the Brexit and the leadership change in the UK and what that's going to mean, both in the short term and the long term, for industrial participation for defense companies and for what the UK is going to look to buy in the coming years. Another thing is the question of how industry is reacting to Asia, to ISIS, kind of reasserting stuff that in 2014 you know, Russia had just invaded Ukraine. ISIS was still a relatively new threat. Now these are major things that all of the defense world is trying to deal with. And I think you're seeing some companies coming here and marketing and trying to sell products specific to those issues.
Yeah. And what have you seen here at the show that's maybe new in the defense realm? We've seen lots of old stuff. We've seen lots of orders being placed on products that are not necessarily new. What's been new here so far this year?
You know, I wish I could tell you there was a whole bunch of new things, but there hasn't been that much. I think you've seen a focus on trainers and light ISR airplanes. There's the DART 450, which is a new one, I believe. I've seen a couple other things like that. Textron has a Scorpion here again, and is close, apparently, to getting at least some sort of customer on that one. It's in a lot of ways the show is similar to where it was in 2014 and to a lesser extent in 2015 in Paris, but I think there's an overriding sense that the defense world has bottomed out. You know, in 2014 it was all about sequestration, all about the budget fights, and now I think you're really seeing people say, "Hey, we've hit the low point." People are starting to buy again. What are the areas where we can look and kind of grow in?
And you mentioned the Scorpion there.
Yeah.
And there was news yesterday that they're going to enter the fray for the UK's training option. What's the view stateside about that aircraft? Because it's been quietly appearing in lots of places. Hasn't got any orders yet, but still gently working away. And now we've seen this announcement.
Yeah, I think everyone I've talked to ever about Scorpion says it's a great jet. It's a great design. They're hitting all their promises. It's, you know, about $3,000 an hour to fly. It can put all sorts of sensors and gear on. It's a great plane. Who the heck is going to buy it?
Exactly. No one's buying it.
Right. And the issue is, you know, they came in, I think, with a great plan for 2008.
Yeah.
They had a new aircraft. It would be cheap. You could buy it. And it came out in 2013. And 2013, the U.S. Air Force certainly wasn't looking to add a new piece of equipment. Other nations were worried about their budgets. It simply is a plane that came a little bit too late. I think what they're doing now, based on an interview I've done with people in the company, is looking less to sell to an actual nation and more to sell to a service. You know, the ASDOT, the training UK thing, the idea is they would sell to Kinetic and Detalis if they win the compact. They wouldn't sell to the UK. They sell to the companies. Bill Anderson, who's the head of Textron Airland, told me, we think there's also a market for ISR service, maybe even selling Scorpion to other Textron companies that do ISR service for countries.
Okay. Okay.
So I think they figured out that's a way they can start to maybe to get some sales on this thing.
Yeah.
A lot of countries remain interested. A lot of people in the U.S. Air Guard look at this and say, this is a really good plan for our needs. But they need to get somebody to buy some first so they can get on the line and prove that this thing actually has legs.
Yeah.
And the beginning of this week was all about the appearance of the F-35, of course. And I've still yet to see it, so I've seen it plenty of times.
It's fine. You're permit blue.
All right, thanks for that. Going back stateside, what's the news over there in terms of aviation defense and so forth? We've just seen the F-18 fly, great demo as always. What's the new stateside?
You know, it's a lot of, as I said, that they think they're coming out of sequestration. There's more stability. Right now, the big things to keep an eye on are the fight over the future of the F-18. Obviously, Boeing wants to extend the line. The Navy wants to extend the line. There's potential maybe in Canada they can steal that away from the F-35. But there's a question of funding, and certainly the U.S. Air Force would rather that money as a whole be going to them than to the Navy for new planes. The big question right now is the budget. You know, we're in this system right now where a budget is unlikely to pass in the U.S. It's likely to go under a continuing resolution, which locks in the budget on last year's funding and basically makes new starts impossible to do.
Yeah.
And that's likely to last until after the election, it looks like. So then the big question becomes, who wins the election?
Yeah.
If, you know, it's one candidate, there's going to be a reaction of the Congress, depending on the fallout. For instance, if the Democrats win the presidency and the Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate might be more willing to deal and give up certain concerns to fund defense because they want to get that done before the Democrats take over.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of, it's certain uncertainty. Everyone expected a continuing resolution.
Yeah.
We've certainly done it plenty of times. We know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the big issue right now is how is the details are going to shake out.
Right, okay.
We're in Boeing Chalet doing this interview at the moment. They've been very kind to us today. I don't want to blot my copybook here, but what about the tanker? How's that progressing?
Yeah, so actually today we... toot my horn a little bit. We broke the story that the KC-46 tanker actually refueled with a new repaired boom, the F-16 and the C-17.
Yeah.
So the issue with the tanker, which caused a in May they announced it would be delayed a couple of months. The called the RAA, which was a requirement to have 18 tankers ready to go on the flight line by August 2017. That's not going to be January 2018. The issue there was that the boom was having fuel flow problems when it got into heavier aircraft like C-17. It was basically too much fuel going. Boeing went back, they added, it's about the size of a book, and it basically shunts the fuel back in and helps control it. They started flying that last week and have already now successfully done the F-16 and C-17. That's a huge step. I'm told the A-10 is coming soon. Once that's done, they can enter Milestone C, which is basically the kind of final give okay to get this thing going. So it was a rough start. Frank Kendall, who's the acquisition head on Sunday, said he's looking for compensation from Boeing for the delay. There's a lot of talk about how that might shake out, especially because any delay to the 46 coming on means that the 135s and the 10s, the existing tanker fleets, have to last longer, so that's cost for the Air Force. The good news from the Air Force point of view is that any costs on the 46 were capped at $4.9 million for engineering and development. Boeing is already $1.5 billion over that, and that's before this most current delay. Their earnings calls will soon, we assume there's going to be a more charge than that. But as far as the Air Force is concerned, the 46 design is good. It's going to be a great plane. Boeing just needs to deliver on it.
Anything else before we go?
Yeah, I think I just want to hit there seems to be more optimism here, and that was definitely in contrast to 2014.
It does feel a bit more positive.
Yeah, I think people really do feel we've bottomed out, and we're going to keep going. I would also say keep an eye on the ISR sector going forward. I think we're seeing a lot of people who stuff with sensors, with unmanned systems, and light aircraft that are kind of innovative. And I think that when we talk again in Paris, we'll see a lot more of that stuff out there.
Right. Aaron, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, man. Great to be here.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
I hope you've enjoyed that little sample of interviews from Farnborough 2016. There is a massive amount to see at the show, and hopefully if you're getting to the public displays this weekend, you'll get to see almost all of what we've seen and lots more. Really, we could have spent hours and hours and hours and hours recording interviews, but we've sampled a few for you here today. In the background, you can hear the 787 winding up. We've seen the Airbus contingents today already, and we've also got Antonov just about to fire up as well. But today's show has featured Boeing. We're very, very grateful for all the kind support that the team at Boeing have given to help us produce this show. So a big thank you to the whole team there. And we hope we're going to bring you some more coverage of Boeing in the UK in the coming months. And with the arrival of the music, that's our coverage from Farnborough 2016. I hope you've enjoyed it. So it's goodbye from Tim Robinson and from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. Aerospace Radio Station, extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
This is XTP Media.